This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, a new effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's been a long time since I've been this excited about a new natural medical innovation. Zona Plus is the real deal. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally. To find out more, go to tryzona.com or call toll-free 1-888-408-6141. That's 1-888-408-6141 or tryzona.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Once again, it is time for a weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. With me today, Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. She's a registered dietitian. She has a master's degree in the field of nutrition and a whole lot of initials after her name. It's very impressive. Okay. Many initials. So, eminently qualified to team up with me to answer your questions. You can send your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. And an additional note is if you want to record a question for our weekend radio program, you can go to our website at drhoffman.com. And there's a black bar on the right side of our homepage. If you click on that, it'll prompt you to record a question. So that's another way you can get questions to us, even if you don't call during our live show on weekends, Saturdays from 12 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. That being said, so how are you doing this week?
All right, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Good, good. Before we get to questions, as we usually do, let me share one of the interesting stories from this week. And it starts in a kind of an unpromising, kind of boring way. But this is like how my mind works. I see a story here on Science Daily entitled Research Team First to Identify AF1Q Protein Associated with Multiple Myeloma Extramedullary Disease. Okay. Yeah. And that sounds kind of boring.
Or our listeners are probably scratching their heads saying, what's that?
But what it ties to is the use of a popular nutraceutical in the treatment of a couple of really serious diseases. And the story, it's from Washington University in St. Louis. Engineering team finds compound may halt molecular cause of often fatal condition. Well, that got my attention. What compound is that?
Whoa.
And it turns out it's a natural compound, well known to many of us, and which many of us take on a daily basis, I do anyway, it's EGCG from green tea.
Oh!
Team of engineers say a compound found in green tea could have life-saving potential for patients with multiple myeloma and amyloidosis. Now, amyloidosis, an uncommon condition, but an almost invariably fatal condition,
yes,
treated with bone marrow transplants, where literally amyloid, which is kind of a gunk, gunks up all your cells. It could affect the heart, causing heart failure. It could affect the brain. Amyloid plaque is associated with Alzheimer's disease. So, you scroll down and read the story. What they say is that there's a pathway, which was that obscure pathway that I first referenced. Yeah, but whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a little technical. What they found is that EGCG also may have a beneficial effect in Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease. And they came to a similar conclusion in bone marrow patients. The EGCG transformed light chain amyloid, preventing the misshapen protein from replicating and accumulating dangerously.
Wow.
So this is very cool. And it adds to our list of conditions for which EGCG confuse it here. In this article, they write EGCG, EGCD, and then they write ECGC.
A little dyslexia.
Which is common. It's like CBGB,
right.
CBGB is an old rock venue in New York City, you know,
like right.
the Ramones and, you know, the 1980s
yeah.
punk tradition. So it's uh-huh. it's not ECGC, it's EGCG. Anyway, it doesn't say precisely how much. It doesn't also say that it's curative.
Uh-huh.
It just helps.
Yeah.
And in a recent interview I did with Glenn Sabin, who is the author of Anne of One. It's an interesting book about his saga with chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL.
Yes. Yeah.
He developed it in 1991. Now, that's 26 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he is disease-free now, never having undergone any kind of conventional treatment. And
wow.
Back in the 90s, he was told that he might need a bone marrow,
mm-hmm.
a stem cell bone marrow transplant, you know, where they obliterate your immune system, completely irradiate you, and then insert somebody's donor marrow into your bone marrow.
Yeah.
And he said no because 20% fatality. Among the things he takes are EGCG. And I asked him, so how much do you take? And he said, what he said was initially he took about 10 or 12 of what the equivalent is to our EGCG Ultra, which is
okay.
one of our best-selling products at drhoffman.com. And
uh-huh.
it's the most potent form of EGCG you can get. So 10 or 12, that's quite a lot.
Yeah.
I wouldn't recommend you take, you know, routinely everybody take that. But under some doctor's supervision, you can go pretty aggressive on EGCG, maybe in conditions like this, because these are conditions that don't invariably respond to conventional treatment. There are decent treatments now for multiple myeloma. There are not great treatments for amyloidosis, and certainly not for Alzheimer's.
Yeah, yeah. Well, except a ketogenic diet and...
Well, no, I'm talking about conventional treatments. Yeah.
Conventional, yeah.
I have a relative who got older, very mm-hmm. forgetful, always complaining about her memory.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting to the point where, you know, I showed up and said, okay, so we're going out tonight. And I'd made the appointment that week. She said, oh, we're going out tonight. I'd made another date. I said, oh, this is getting bad. So
uh-huh.
the next time she went to the doctor, I spoke to her doctor and we said, let's put her on an Alzheimer's medication. And both of us agreed it wasn't.
Aricept?
Yes. And both of us agreed it wasn't going to help very much.
Huh.
I have a little trouble with my relatives, as you probably do.
Sure.
They don't always listen. Have you noticed that?
Oh, my. I thought it was some kind of cosmic joke at some point in the beginning.
It's
wow.
It's like karmic payback. We advise people day in, day out, and they pay.
Uh-huh.
But when it comes to relatives,
they look at me like I have two heads.
Yeah, and they don't. It doesn't carry the weight somehow.
It doesn't.
Well, it
it's
depends.
Like, what do you
it
know?
Depends.
You're my kid, or you're my niece, or you're my
right.
second cousin.
I changed your diapers.
My...
I mean, how could you?
Right.
Okay. So enough said. These are this. It's kind of a hopeful story. All right. And it pays sometimes to dig a little bit in the literature, because what seem to be sort of boring, nondescript stories sometimes turn into stories with practical import, news that you can use.
Yeah. I mean, besides you, Dr. Hoffman, I've heard at least a couple of other doctors say at various medical conventions that I've attended that EGCG is one of the most chemotherapeutic agents ever.
Yeah, exactly.
So besides for something like CLL, but so many other cancers
mm-hmm.
and things. So... take your EGCG, drink your green tea, all of the above.
I hate green tea.
Yeah,
I just don't.
I'm not a fan of green tea either. I'm a classic English breakfast.
Once or twice a year, I have a yen and I have some green tea.
Yeah.
And then I go back to my decaf after that.
Yeah. At a Japanese restaurant, I will indulge.
Yep. I like that.
But you know what's interesting? I think something has to do, texture-wise, not with the tea, but from the cup that it's served in.
Okay.
In a Japanese restaurant, it's like a thicker porcelain, as opposed to my little, you know, Wexford, China, thin porcelain. I think that might have something to do with it. It's like using a metal fork utensil rather than wooden chopsticks.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, there's, and also the setting of the Japanese restaurant,
maybe.
The food is compatible.
Kind of all goes with it.
Yeah, I mean, I say bring me some green tea. I'm all for it.
It goes with the Asian ginger dressing on that beautiful salad.
Since I'm not slugging down a lot of sake these days. I drink the green tea.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get to questions, please.
Yes. Okay, we've got an email from Bonnie. Bonnie says, I love your podcasts. They are the bright spot in my day. Thank you, Bonnie. I take a number of supplements that call for twice a day intake. Can I take both at the same time? Or do they have to be separated by hours during the day? It's much more convenient to pop two at a time. But is there a downside to doing that? Well, it depends. Depends on the supplement. First of all, I think a more obvious one for us would be vitamin C, because your body will only absorb so much. Bonnie, I don't think it's in your best interest to take 2,000 milligrams of vitamin C all at breakfast or at lunch, because your body's not going to absorb more
There's
than
a threshold.
About 1,000.
There's a
there
threshold.
Is. Yeah,
and
there is.
The threshold has been variously estimated. In one study I saw, it was about 550 or 600 is the threshold for absorption. And the more you take beyond that, the less your body absorbs.
Yes.
So
And the more expensive your urine gets.
Right. And so if you want to take a lot of vitamin C, take it every 3-4 hours. You know, say you have a cold, you know, take 1,000 five times a day through the day.
What would you say to 2,000 milligrams of EGCG during one meal or something like that? Considering what this other doctor said, taking so many.
Yeah, we don't know, because it might be that in that case, that gives you a real sharp pulse in your EGCG, which may have a knock out the cancer rather than spreading it out, you know, like a low dose through, you know, many times during the day. So how you take it might be important. I don't think that's been looked at.
Right. There are other, maybe more energizing supplements. If you're going to take something like Niacel or CoQ10, should you take your entire dose at dinner? I don't know.
Probably some people say that, and I've noticed this a little bit, when you take something like Niacel late at night, I'm a good sleeper, but fabulous dreams and kind of a restless sleep.
Right.
Because it energizes the brain.
Yeah. Bonnie.
Not in a caffeinated way, not in a caffeine-like way.
Right. Because it's constituent of our metabolism, particularly the Krebs cycle. Bonnie, I would say to you, if it's more convenient to take most of the doses of your vitamins during one time, I guess you take it to bowel tolerance. Mm-hmm. Again, my original example of too much vitamin C may cause a very loose stool or a diarrhea.
Yeah, I find I take my vitamins at breakfast and lunch, and I always like to leave dinner like kind of relatively untrammeled, because it's more of a relaxed experience. I'm virtuous in the morning.
Right.
I'm pretty disciplined midday. Uh-huh. But at night, I just kind of don't want to be bothered.
Right. I'll do most of mine at night, but some in the morning.
Okay.
Breakfast, depending on the size of breakfast. That's
if you're having
thing.
Like a really tiny meal and you got a whole bunch of supplements, you may not want to take. And you,
exactly.
Say you wake up, it's very early, you want a very small meal.
Yeah.
You're a little, maybe you don't have a lot of hunger.
Right.
And you're maybe a little nauseous.
Yes. That would be the downside.
Yeah.
Bonnie's asking, is there any downside? That would be the only downside, is that if your meal isn't big enough and you've taken quite a bit.
Now, with a fat soluble vitamin, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Because, for example, you can take vitamin D, it's been shown in studies, once a week or even once a month at very high doses, and or vitamin A. Actually, there's some studies where they try to treat kids who are at risk for immune problems in remote parts of the world, like Nepal or in equatorial Africa, and the health worker comes in, gives them a massive dose once, and then they say goodbye, because I'm going to 20 other villages and I'll see you in a couple of months or, you know, I'll see you in 3 months. And then you'll get another pill.
Right.
And if you do the math, it's you know, a reasonable dose on a daily basis, but it's a pulse dose. It stays in your system for a while.
Yeah.
And it's studies show that it's delivered slowly through the system when it's fat soluble. But water soluble, B's and C's have to be dosed several times during the day, sometimes to be effective.
Then that would be the other one that I wouldn't take all at once. You don't want to take, you know, if you're taking 100 milligram, say, B complex twice a day, I wouldn't double it up and take the whole 200.
And you might risk flushing because of the high niacin content of that. I used to, when I used to take, more of the B complex, and I would notice, you know, I get to work, I take off my coat, I comb my hair, straighten my tie, and I'd look in the mirror and I'd go, oh my goodness, your face is flushed. What's up with that? And I'd think, you know, I just took, like an hour ago, I took my high, you know, ultra potent B complex, and the niacin was causing a little flushing.
There you go.
So for some people, that might be uncomfortable taking all the B vitamins at once.
The antidote to that is to take quercetin about 30 minutes before.
That's what I hear. I don't know. I hear that. Niacin. I don't know how effective it is. Maybe some people have noticed that that helps.
Yeah. Anyway, Bonnie, keep taking your supplements. And thank you for your question. All right. We have a question from JD. Hello, I listened to your podcast about IBS some time ago, and I wondered, how do we know, what is the evidence that probiotics survive passage through the stomach? And also, if a patient's taken antibiotics, doesn't the colon become recolonized as opposed to having persistent changes to flora? Well, that depends.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the last question is driving at.
Yeah.
Do you understand that?
Not completely. Also, if a patient has antibiotics, doesn't the colon become recolonized?
Well, it does become recolonized. Actually, this pertains to the newly discovered function of the appendix. Is it's thought that the appendix may be, it's a cul-de-sac. You know, so it's actually not, it's a little bit like a off-ramp of the intestinal tract. And it's thought to be a repository for beneficial bacteria that can then recolonize the intestine, not so much when you use antibiotics, but when you get sick and say you have some disruptive influence in your intestines, so that they come back from there, because it seems that whatever pathogens, it's a little harder for them to get to the appendix. Anyway, so...
And that's a recent discovery.
It used to be thought that the appendix was a source of lymphoid tissue, like the tonsils, which it is. It has a lot of lymphoid tissue, and it was like an immune organ. And then they sought to prove that people without an appendix had more or less of certain problems. It wasn't clear. So, in regards to the first question, the more important question is, you know, probiotics vary in their ability to colonize the intestine. And some of it depends on the quality of the probiotic.
Yes.
And some of it depends on the terrain into which they're introduced. So some people have a receptivity to probiotics, and other people have a resistance to probiotics, possibly because of their immune system, possibly because of their, it's genetic, or possibly because of the other bacteria that may repel or inhibit the colonization by these bugs. There's also variabilities in quality of probiotics, the viability of the probiotics. Some are require refrigeration. No, Dr. Here is actually a fermented product that is fine at room temperature and doesn't require refrigeration.
I also want to remind I want to remind JD that there are two schools of thoughts on when to take probiotics too, which also has possibly something to do with its survival through the passage
stomach
of the
acid.
Stomach is the stomach acid.
Right.
Some argue that we have the least stomach acid when we haven't eaten. That's the time to take it. And others say, no, the least stomach acid is after we've eaten and that food has absorbed.
Well, the food may buffer the, in other words, protect the probiotic from the stomach acid. So, and that, you know, frankly, that hasn't really been worked out.
Right. We have a similar question.
And then
question.
There's also these questions, there's also this issue of enteric coated probiotics, because we know that probiotics, we really don't want them to work necessarily in the stomach, which is sterile mostly, although stomach has H. pylori and a certain other bacteria. But the stomach is relatively few bacteria. The small intestine has more, but usually not that many unless you have SIBO, which is small intestine bacterial overgrowth. The large intestine is where the bacterial population of the microbiome should reside. And so the idea is use an enteric capsule which resists the stomach acid and then opens up in your large intestine. And that's a reasonable idea, but I don't think it's really been demonstrated conclusively that that is superior. You know, there's a lot of probiotic research ongoing, research on the microbiome. I think we're going to get this right eventually.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'll stay tuned. You know, we'll keep you posted with the latest studies on this.
Talking more about probiotics, John emailed, "Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. I use a daily probiotic. It works very well for me. However, it's when my sister uses my brand of probiotic, she feels very bloated."
Different strokes for different folks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when she uses an alternative brand, she feels fine and so forth.
And that's why.
So it's about the variation in gut flora.
Yeah, it's a little bit, you know, I have to say that our current status with probiotics is a little bit like the status of psychiatric medications.
Yeah.
It's sort of like there's no, you know, we'll try this, we'll try that. We it's like throwing darts at the dartboard, and no way of knowing how people are going to respond.
Mm-hmm.
With psychiatric medications, we're now beginning to have some genetic tests that show maybe you're more likely to respond to something or other.
Yeah.
But that's in its infancy. With antihypertensive drugs, mm-hmm. same thing. It's sort of like, well, this sounds a little like you might respond to this or that. The type of hypertension you have is mm-hmm. likely to respond to this or that. Or maybe it's even based on racial types, is that African Americans respond better to certain things, Caucasians to other things.
Due to their
genetics, yeah, mm-hmm. and, you know, some physiological differences.
John makes an important point here. I want to go on. He asks, is it possible that the bloating my sister experiences when she uses my probiotic is a sign that there's a more positive change in her flora and maybe she should just tough it out?
Exactly. That is a good point, is that there could be an initial sort of a die-off reaction, we could call it, that other things are being knocked out or that there's an explosive kind of growth of certain bacteria, which eventually the body will acclimate to.
Right. He also mentioned she is lactose intolerant. Could that be a factor?
Well, some of these things are milk-based.
If it's a dairy-based probiotic, she should move away from that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then maybe that's why, John, that her brand is working for her and yours for you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you for your questions, JD and John. Oh, okay. We've got a question here. Wow, I don't have a name. I've had insomnia since menopause, as well as my mother had, and I was prescribed Ambien. I've decreased the dose from 10 milligrams to 5 milligrams. My general practitioner claims it causes dementia and advised trazodone.
Okay.
100 milligrams.
Wow.
Claiming to be an effective sleep aid without dementia side effects. What do you think of that?
Yeah, this is interesting. You know, when it comes to medication, you know, Ambien is probably the most widely used sleep medication, but it's a benzodiazepine. And benzodiazepines can cause hangover, they can cause mental dullness. Mm. And especially in older individuals, they don't metabolize it as well. And they may have kind of a stoner hangover effect after taking it. And if you're on the cusp, see, I think we proceed from the assumption that younger people have a lot more cognitive reserve. In other words, we do pretty well with kind of half our brains tied behind our backs, you know, right? There's some mornings where you manage to get through it even though you're not feeling good. But with an older individual, they don't have as much cognitive reserve, and it takes a little less to tip them into dementia, confusion, or memory loss. And so that Ambien could be the straw that breaks the camel's back if they're on the verge of experiencing dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some studies that associate, it not necessarily that it causes more dementia, it just like damages the brain. Maybe it does, but that's one theory. But another theory is that it just interferes with the limited cognitive reserve that you have. It scrambles your brain function that is already impaired.
I would imagine that older people are going to have a shrinking hippocampus too, and that certainly doesn't help matters.
Right.
You know, I wonder also, I remember a joke going around about Ambien. It was quite funny that, you know, you wake up in the middle of the night and you're almost like having a sleepwalking or other life effect. Is that so? Have you heard of anything like that?
Oh, yeah. There's also people who have sex and don't remember it. The other thing that is of interest here is trazodone has now become popular as a sleep remedy. Trazodone is an antidepressant medication that is sedating. So it's generally given at night.
Okay.
And they found that it helps people sleep.
Yeah.
But that's a much too high dose for
100
milligrams.
I wonder generally, if it's a typo, but
yeah. It generally, we're talking like maybe 5 or 10 maybe of trazodone. And it's now been rejiggered. I forget the name of the sleep medication that has been renamed. It's low-dose trazodone for sleep. And I can look that up. But it's actually pretty effective, I found, for some of my patients for sleep.
I've heard that from a lot of people saying, I can't sleep without it, which is unfortunate, but I'm glad that something is working for them and if they tolerate it well and if they get a good night's sleep,
yeah,
it's in their best interest. Sure.
Yeah, yeah, that's actually, I'm Googling it now. It says Ambien or Trazodone, which is best for sleep? One post says, I assure you that Trazodone will work much better, capitalized M-U-C-H.
Wow.
It's an antidepressant used for sleep. It's an off-label option. Means that they take that they use
a much lower dose for
lower dose,
as opposed for using it for depression.
Yeah, it's also referred to as Desirel, but I think the mistake is that they're using a pretty high dose. Well, yeah, I don't know. I see some of the dosages here. Trazodone for sleep dose to 100 milligrams, 50 milligrams, 150 milligrams. I would start kind of low. Okay. And it's much less addictive.
That's good.
Okay.
That's great. Wow.
Dry mouth is a side effect.
Sure. Keep a glass of water on your nightstand.
Right. Okay. So as our listeners know, we divide these podcasts into two parts. And we will answer more questions in part two. Give us a preview of what we're going to do in part two.
Dr. Hoppen, we have a couple of people asking about your top 10 supplements for 2017.
Oh, exciting. Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
So when we come back. All right.